Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome to another episode of Lost in the Static. I am Josh Hadley, and I am not Glenn Criddle.
No, you're not. I'm Glenn Criddle. And Spartacus.
I thought, but then who is Sarah Hanley?
I might be Josh Hadley.
Ooh, isn't that deep? You want to speak of something? You want to speak of something else that's deep and possibly kinky? AdamandEve.com. These are just getting more seamless. It's almost like we planned these. You go to AdamandEve.com, use the promo code STATIC, and you would get 10 free gifts. You'd get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free U.S. shipping. And also, not as kinky, go to drivethroughrpg.com and check out Al Seeger's role-playing game systems. He has a systemless settings bundle, but that's not what he's pushing right now. He's got a lot of really cool role-playing games, not the sexual role-playing minds out of the gutter, people. And tell him you heard about his role-playing games on Lost and Static, and you'll get a light bulb joke, which, again, is not sexual, but will make sense down the line. Now, that said, what I want to talk about tonight is ownership. Now, this is going to sound less legally as we get into it, but what does it mean to own or author a media property? What prompted this is DC Comics' recent dick move. What they did is they said, okay, they had a royalty program in place where if you all the people who created, say, the Green Lantern versions and the Flash side characters and all this stuff back in the 60s and 70s and all that, they got royalties every time those were used in a TV show or a movie. Fair enough, or even on a t-shirt. So a couple of years ago, they rebooted everything and redesigned every character in what was known as New 52. So a longtime DC Comics writer named Jerry Conway said, well, bunch of my characters are being used in the new Flash TV show. Why am I not getting royalties on that? DC said, well, see, because we redesigned the characters for the new 52, we're not using your version on the TV show, so we don't owe you royalties. He said, you know what? That's fair. So at least the people who redesigned the Flash side characters are getting the royalties, right? They said, no, they're not, because you don't get royalties for something that's derivative of something else. So those characters that are being used in the TV show are derivative of the characters you created, so we don't have to pay them royalties at all. Therefore, nobody legally created these characters that are on the TV show and coming into the new Justice League movie, so therefore we don't have to pay royalties to anybody. Glenn, do you see what I was talking about with that being a real dick move? We don't owe royalties to anybody because of legalese.
Yeah, it's a pretty awful situation. And I read the article when you sent it over to me. It's one of those things where the company is trying desperately to find their little ways around all the ways that their money's going to go out. And it's completely a dick move. It's a very, very cynical move to do that, you know, because it's basically taking the money out of the pockets of the creators, which is a really terrible thing to do. And it kind of reminds me of what Gene Roddenberry did with the Star Trek theme, the original Star Trek theme. Did you know about that?
No, by original Star Trek, you mean when he first created, quote, Wagon Train to the Stars, or his whole my characters wouldn't act this way kind of thing, even though Paramount actually owns the characters.
No, what I'm talking about is the theme tune to the original Star Trek series.
How it originally had lyrics, but then he said if we take out the lyrics, we don't have to pay royalties to the fucking guy who wrote it.
It was the other way around. He actually wrote lyrics deliberately without actually wanting to use it. He just wrote those because then it became part of the music, and then the situation was, as you said, then he takes a certain amount of the royalties of whenever it's played or used and all that kind of stuff, basically taking money straight out of the pocket of the guy that actually, you know, came up with the music in the first place. It's a very similar sort of thing, and it's just it's absolutely despicable in my opinion. But I mean, I don't know how the creators are supposed to get around that kind of stuff, because, you know, I mean, they're sort of writing the rules and they're the company that people go to work for. And can you just walk away from something like Marvel?
Well, I think that the only way that you could get away with doing this, being a big company that doesn't want to pay money when it feels that it doesn't have to, is if nobody asked about anybody else. It completely hinges on everybody being blindingly selfish. And in the act of him asking, well, I'm not getting this money, but the guys that you commission to create these characters differently are getting the money, that's when the door was opened. When you start to ask about the well-being of others, such a really delicate pyramid falls apart. Because
that also shows what a good guy Jerry Conway was, though. That, hey, you know, fine. You know, that's a fair enough argument that I'm not getting my royalties, but somebody is, right? That actually shows he's a really good guy about this, doesn't it, though, Sarah?
Oh, I totally believe so. And since the names of these people are on the books, even if it didn't get out the way that it did, I don't doubt that he would contact them directly. And then you would have all of the parties, of which some of them should have been getting the credit and the royalties, would be together as a unified front.
Well, that's kind of what happened in the DC case. Once all this went public, Time Warner, which owns DC Comics, or which owns Warner Brothers, which owns DC Comics, if you really want to get down the line, they kind of went, no. That's totally wrong. No. See, that was the right hand not knowing what the left hand was doing. We never intended to rip anybody off, and all of your back royalty checks are coming in the mail now. Is it kind of that they would have tried to get away with this if it hadn't have come to light? Does that not show just how scummy this whole business really is?
Oh, it's dirty and cynical, and they would have tried to get away with it for years if possible. It's the same way that if you don't read your bills for phone companies and stuff, they'll slip in extra fees, and then when you call them on it, they go, oh, wait, that wasn't a thing that you actually had ordered, and we weren't supposed to charge you for that. Ah, our mistake? Gosh.
Yeah, they require an ignorant populace. But this is not just confined to comic books. This happens in movies, in music. This happens in every kind of creative medium. For instance, Glenn, since you're a movie guy, who would you say is the creator of any given movie? Now, let's leave out the fact of people like Orson Welles, who are writer, director, producer, star. I mean, when you have a different writer, a different director, a different star and whatnot for a single movie, who is the author of the movie in your mind?
Well, I think generally it's accepted that the director would be identified as the author of the film. Obviously, you know, a film, TV, even comic books are a collaborative effort. So there is a big team of people going around. But usually when you think of something like a film, the first person you think of as the creator would be the director. It's the most natural sort of choice to go to. Although it has to be said, there are quite a few films which are being claimed much more by studios as opposed to directors these days. Not that that's particularly new in the kind of control stakes, but I mean, for me, yeah, I would have to say the director.
See, what you're talking about is called the auteur theory, which the Writers Guild has been fighting for years, and they still can't get rid of that, is the director, except in cases like, you know, where the director is also the writer. The director didn't create anything. All he did is guide everything else. He didn't create these characters. He didn't create the situation. He didn't create the dialogue. So why is he the author of the project? They have been fighting that a film by credit for so long, where you know, a film by Martin Scorsese. Martin Scorsese didn't write it. He didn't produce it. Or even the bullshit that they started pulling in the late 90s of Wes Craven presents, you know, Clive Barker presents, where these people didn't direct the movie. They didn't write it. They didn't even produce it. In the case of the Wes Craven Presents line, he never saw the movies until after they were done. So why is he the author of the film?
Well, in that sense, you're not talking about a director, you're talking about a producer, and that's a completely different matter. And yeah, I think films that are touted by producer credits seems a little odd. I've never quite understood why that would be the case. When it comes to directors, though, generally, if you've got a decent director, they are controlling the look. They are controlling to an extent what words are said on screen, how they're said. They manipulate all the various elements, in which comes from everything from the lighting and sound through to the writing, to the set design, to how the cinematography is handled, to lesser or greater degrees depending on the director. But the director,
which none of which would happen if there was not the writer to have given them all of that, and then they just, and writers are basically shit on in Hollywood. That's why I don't like the auteur theory. I really don't.
Well, I'm certainly not trying to underplay the role of the writer. The writer is an incredibly important part of it, and there ought to be much more recognition for their role in the filmmaking. But when it comes to the overall finished product of the film, it is the director that has much more control over what happens. The writing, as important as it is, what you have on a script is not what you necessarily see in the final product.
I'll come back to why that's not always a good thing in a minute. Because, mm-hmm. And Glenn, we disagree, and that's fine. I mean, I don't want you to think that I'm bitching at you because we disagree.
No.
Sarah, do you side with mommy or daddy?
It's so funny that you brought that up, because I was going to use that as an example. There is a really old saying that says a hit film has 1,000 fathers, a failure is an orphan. Because I think that unfortunately for each film, you'd have to look at its DNA. You can say, here is a child that was fathered by both Glenn and Josh, and I let's leave that alone.
There's some slash fic coming, huh, Glenn?
Oh no.
Yes, is this Josh's child or is this Glenn's? I think that one of the unfortunately easiest way to go about that would be to compare the finished product to the script as it is. If you look at let's say Watchmen, where it can be argued, just took the comic as it was and put it up on the screen with one or two changes to it. So would that be the work of him, or would that be the work of the original comic book creators who basically had the same work but not moving? If you look at Ghostbusters, there's a lot of scenes that were completely improvised right there on the set. So is that the work of the director who's behind the camera, or is that the work of the actor who's coming up with the things as he's being filmed?
In the case of Ghostbusters, I'll say that still works into the writer, because two of those three main actors also wrote the script.
But yeah, unfortunately, it's less of a meal at a restaurant where you have the person who is the main chef conducting everyone through it, then you have, I don't want to compare it to a demolition, but it everything has to be planned before you even give the person the button to push it. The director is the person pushing the button, the writer is the person who plans out how each of those bombs are going to go off. And
you
wow,
can't
this
build
has gone
a building without plans, though. And yet the directors often look at the writer as just a piece of shit, as just something that they don't have to deal with. Like, are either of you familiar with the disaster that was the movie Altered States in 1980?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you guys know the behind the scenes of why that movie is so bizarrely directed?
No, I don't actually.
Okay, it was based on a novel by Paddy Chayefsky, the writer of Network. Now, Paddy Chayefsky wrote the screenplay as well, and he had so much power in Hollywood at the time, which is almost unheard of for a writer. It was written into his contract that not a single word of his script could be changed by director Ken Russell without Chayefsky's express approval. That's never happened before or since, and you'll find out why. Now, Ken Russell was at the tail end of his career. He was a drunk. Most of the stories from the set say he was directing drunk and that the AD actually directed half the movie because Ken Russell couldn't even stand up. And Ken Russell had the whole auteur theory that I am the author. Paddy Chayefsky went on record that Ken Russell was like, I'm going to change this dialogue even though I legally can't because the script, the contract says I can't because he wanted to, quote, tailor it to himself. So what he would do is, to get around this, he pulled the ultimate, kind of a genius, but ultimate dick move. I'm going to have the actors shoot the scenes in the script as written, but I'm going to have them shout random parts, or say parts really slow, or mumble lines, and then have them do the, quote, good takes on the scenes that he rewrote, therefore forcing the studio's hand in editing to use his rewritten scenes. Well, the studio, knowing that they would have to pay Chayefsky so much money for Ken Russell's dick moves, called his bluff. And they used his, quote, bad takes of the actual scripted scenes in the movie. That's why characters all of a sudden in the middle of a dialogue scene, hey, what do you want for dinner? And things like that. Because the studio was like, fuck you, Ken Russell. You're going to cost us millions of extra dollars because, according to Ken Russell, the writer is not the author of the film. He gave an interview, I, as director, am the author of this film. And Paddy Chayefsky said, no, you're not. Now, when you see Altered States, doesn't that make a little bit more sense, Glenn, why the movie is kind of bizarrely directed like that? Or edited like that, I should say, because the studio was like, fuck you, Russell, we're calling your bluff.
Yes, it does. And, you know, I mean, it's not to say that directors should ever think that they are almighty or the only piece of the puzzle. The director, for me, the best directors are the ones that can find people that they work with well, and they pull the skills and experience and talents of those around them. It's the directors that think that they are the be-all and end-all that tend to fall on their own sword, so to speak. Some of the worst films I've seen have been results of that. Altered States is kind of mad. I didn't realize it had quite that much of a mad history. And yeah, thinking back, yeah, it certainly looks like it suffered from that.
The movie makes more sense now that you've heard that story, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It certainly does. It certainly does. And Ken Russell was kind of infamous for being somewhat of an eccentric.
Don't say eccentric. He was an arrogant jackass.
He could be. Yeah, absolutely, he could be. Mark Kermode, the British critic, film critic, was quite good friends with him. But when he first met, he was doing an interview in front of a cinema audience who were just about to watch a screening of The Devils. And he just got up and walked out halfway through the interview. And just completely fucked with this film critic, you know, right in front of people, just because he thought it'd be fun. That's the kind of guy he was.
Are you sure he didn't see something shiny and get distracted?
It's quite possible he might have heard there was whiskey in the foyer.
Yeah, because like I said, he was He was pretty much a drop-down drunk, and then after Altered States failed, he kind of got his comeuppance by being exiled to TV movie hell for the rest of his career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, he suffered for that.
It sounds like he heard the move that they pulled on Star Trek with the kiss, and he was like, I'm going to do that for the entire movie, and no one will stop me.
Except this time, I think it was Paramount. I can't remember what studio Altered States was, but the studio went, we're calling your bluff.
Yeah.
And he'd your name's still going to be on this film. So that, because critics, not knowing this story at the time, were like, what the fuck was Ken Russell thinking when directing this? And then the story wouldn't come out till years later when Paddy Chayefsky told the story to an interviewer. But it kind of like, that makes a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he'd had a history anyway. And, you know, not to drag Ken Russell out for the entire episode. He'd had a history with studios and fighting studios along the way. And, you know, you look at the history of the film The Devils, that was a particularly arduous process.
And I don't one even which think we've have we even to this day ever seen the full version? I heard even the uncut version that's out on DVD now is still missing a few scenes, isn't it?
It is, yes, and that's because the studio won't release it, and it's the American side of the studio, and I can't remember if it's Warner Brothers or
it's either Warner Brothers or MGM, I think.
Yeah, I think it's Warner Brothers, who won't release it, even despite the fact that everybody's going, we want it released, we want it released. They had a real problem with that particular film at the time, and it was as much to do with their own religious sensibilities that they felt they couldn't do it. And to this day, it's turned out it's much more of them being belligerent than anything. So it doesn't look like we'll ever get it. And I wouldn't be surprised if they don't sneakily destroy the rest of the footage. But that's the kind of background that Ken Russell was sort of dealing with up until that point. So to some degree, his foot stamping can be understood in those respects to a little degree, even if it is still wrong and very, very childish.
Well, but it also comes down to, Sarah, you brought up the point that a film has many fathers, but a failure, or a hit film has many fathers, a failure is an orphan. And I disagree with that a little bit. The failure always has one problem, and that is usually the director. And for an example, the 1995 Judge Dredd. Danny mm-hmm. Cannon, the director, came from independent films and went back to independent films. He thought he was actually going to be able to direct Judge Dredd. And then Stallone took over. Stallone was rewriting the scenes, tailoring the movie to himself, armchair directing. Danny Cannon once gave an interview where he said he basically just figured out what the camera angles were going to be. Stallone was essentially directing that movie. But then when it failed, Stallone and the studio all were like, Danny Cannon didn't know what he was doing. He didn't have enough experience. It was Danny Cannon's fault. So they were only, you know, it was Stallone's movie while they were making it. But when it failed, it's Danny Cannon's fault. Sarah, having been on movie sets, you know for a fact that kind of shit happens, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. And you're not going to convince me that they didn't intentionally pick someone who didn't have the experience of being on that large of a set, because there was no way
he's going to stand up to Stallone. No way.
Yeah, because you come believing that you're going to keep this all together. The amount of your ability to do so is partially dependent on your history of having done it. A person who is doing an independent film with, let's say, 10 people, and they're also the crew as well as the cast, that's a completely different skill set than a person who is directing thousands of people that are both crew and cast over, let's say, maybe multiple sets, and you have a second unit director who's filming the stuff that you don't have the time for, and there's no way that the budget can give you the time to do that. There is a reason that people like that not only have an assistant, they also have the script supervisor. They also have the person whose only job is to take pictures to keep consistency. That these are things that you never even have a thought of a need of doing if you're shooting an independent feature. I don't care how big a budget. I don't care if you're getting into the $1 million mark. It's not the same as shooting something that is $20, $30, $50 million. And they knew what they were getting at the time. They knew that they were getting someone who, if not malleable, did not have the knowledge of what he was able to do. And if they got someone who knew what he was supposed to be able to do, he wouldn't have accepted those conditions. Nobody knows at this time why the director of Ant-Man walked away, but I would have expected that if they had gone to someone of the caliber of the larger independent films and said, we're doing Judge Dredd, we're doing it with Stallone, Stallone is going to want to help direct you. Because I'm sure that they tried to introduce it gently at first, because you don't want to shock a person, even if you're going to completely steamroll them.
When you're going to rape somebody, it's best to go in gentle, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You touch the cheek first, and then you gauge the reaction, and then you punch them into the wall.
Exactly. Nice. But, I mean, we've even got a similar case coming out right now with the new Fantastic Four film that hasn't come out yet.
The one that we only have a picture or two?
Well, there's a trailer, and it looks awful. But... Oh, you haven't seen the trailer yet. Oh,
no.
Okay, I'll show it to you after the show. But the director Josh Trank came from low-budget films. And basically, the stories have come out that he was totally difficult on the set. He was indecisive. He didn't know what he wanted. That one of the cast members said he looked like he was in way over his head. And the studio had to hire another director to come in and reshoot a bunch of scenes to, quote, fix Josh Trank's version for release. So it seems like it's almost like a repeat of the Judge Dredd fiasco. They got an indie guy who'd only made one film at that point. He had some shorts, but this was he made Chronicle, that low budget found footage movie.
Yeah.
And somehow they thought that, hey, this little, you know, what was that, $5-10 million film, this guy can direct our $400 million Fantastic Four reboot.
Well, Josh, remember what happened on Alien 3.
Yeah, David Fincher was specifically hired on Alien 3 because they knew they could push him around. Because he was a music video guy just looking for his big break. So Hill and Giler knew exactly what they were doing by hiring someone with no experience. But it's not even always that. Sometimes it's just... Sometimes it is the writer's fault. I mean, you know, you look at like Lost in Space. I listened to the director's Stephen Hopkins commentary, and I really think he was trying to make the best movie he could. But Akiva Goldsman's script was so bad that I don't think there was any way. I don't think James Cameron could have made Lost in Space good having to use that same script.
Well, that also depends on what era James Cameron.
Good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good point. But sometimes the script is the problem. But then other times you have to look at to go back to the auteur theory, Harlan Ellison wrote a fantastic script for an old 60s Western called The Cimarron Strip. And it was, you know, remember it takes place in the 1800s, so this isn't that far-fetched. It was, What if Jack the Ripper was never caught or killed, but instead moved from England to America and then started ripping girls in the new Western frontier. And it's like, okay, that's a great idea. He wrote the opening scene very cinematically. He wrote it in misdirection, in reflections in puddles, and in the reflection in an owl's eye and whatnot. And the director said, and I quote, "I'm not going to let a writer tell me how to direct." And he shot it in slasher movie fashion. And he basically threw out everything unique about the script and said, almost for the arrogance of, I'm going to change everything because no writer is going to tell me how to direct.
The
prevailing attitude, you know, that the writer, there's that old joke in Hollywood. The blonde was so stupid, she tried to get into films. She slept with the writer.
Nice.
You know, the least powerful person on the set. That's why I have such problems with the whole the director is the author thing.
Yeah, but it's also a good example in the opposite direction that you've got a director who has completely trashed a movie. You know, a good director can make a bad film really good or a good film really bad quite easily. As can, you know, several of the key elements, good writing or bad writing. You know, that can really make or break a film.
Oh, I've got a good example. The director is to the writer as the inker is to the penciler.
Oh yeah, I've seen great art ruined by terrible inks when it comes to comics. I've seen, but at the same time, you could even go to the writing. With mm-hmm. comic books, I have seen tremendous scripts that I just cannot get into for just the god-awful artwork. And then on the other side, you've got just gorgeous artwork, and the script is so shallow and terrible.
Yes, but which of those two can you read more of? Because I know one of those you can get through an entire issue, and the other one, it's just too painful.
I would rather have a good script with bad art than great art with a bad script. And I think that's the same way with movies. I'd rather have a really well-written movie that's poorly directed than a beautifully directed movie that's poorly written. Glenn, I'm assuming you're on the same wavelength with that after, you know, having seen your reviews for the last few years.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I mean, if you've got a film that has something like a good story, which is in there, it doesn't necessarily matter how bad the film looks or, you know, how shoddily it's necessarily directed. That core can come through, which is really quite important.
I think that the biggest thing is 60s television. Mm-hmm. Look at something like the original Outer Limits. Mm-hmm. Those had terrible special effects for the most part, and they were just kind of blandly directed. But the stories are so good. You know, you never even notice how goofy the monster looks, you know?
Yeah, where on the other side of that, where if you're watching something and you're following it and you can see, not actually, but you can see plot threads just being dropped and not being completed, and then you get to the end of it and they're having their we're all happy looking at the sunset, and you go, but what about the story?
Well, it even comes down to music. That, you know, who is the true author of you know, a hit rock song? Is it the writer of the song, the singer of the song, or the engineer behind the scenes? Because I have heard great singers with great writing have their songs destroyed by bad engineering. But then you've got beautiful sounding songs that are just shallow and lack substance. And then you've got beautifully written songs where the band can't play for shit. Who is the author when it comes to music then?
I think principally it's got to be the people who write and perform it. They're called groups for a reason, obviously. So in that respect, I would go in that kind of direction.
But in a lot of cases, groups, you'll notice only one or two names of maybe the five people in the group.
Yeah,
on the songwriting credits. So it's not so much a group effort in the creation as more of the production, if that makes sense.
Well, and then you get into the problem of some songs were done by one group or person, and then another group made it popular. You think of Proud Mary, that was made popular by Tina Turner, but it was a song before then.
CCR, wasn't it?
It was either CCR or Mellencamp. I'm being a bad musical person by not knowing that.
I used to work in rock radio, and I'm not 100% sure, so don't feel bad. But no, I see your point. That to me, it always bothers me, and this goes to movies and music and everything, when the inferior remake is what puts it into the popular culture. I mean, like, in the remake culture we have of movies today, who is the author of that? Say, like, as much as I love John Carpenter's version of The Thing from 1982, who's the author of that story? Is it W. Campbell, who wrote the original story? Is it Howard Hawks, who he didn't direct the original, but trust it's Howard Hawks through and through. Howard Hawks, who made Thing from Another World, or John Carpenter? When you've got the same story being told in multiple ways, who is the true author then? Glenn?
With something like The Thing, I go with John Carpenter. It's got such a strong feel of him throughout it. That is, you watch that, you can definitely tell it's a John Carpenter film, and that's where you're getting into auteur again, I guess, but it's so clearly his work. Yeah, you know, I mean, he's got all those other things which are going on in there, and there's The Thing before, but I mean, if you look at the original and you look at John Carpenter's versions, they're almost completely different in most important respects. How it looks, how it feels, how it sounds, the tone of it is all what he's brought to it. And that's what the director does. If they're any good, is they bring their own stamp to the product, even if it's a remake.
Well, then let's swing this to comic books, which is kind of a general look at Hollywood. Who is the actual author of something when you are work for hire? Work for hire would be you make this for the company. You know, you write this film for Warner Brothers. You write this comic and create this character for DC Comics or Marvel Comics or whatnot. Who is the actual author? Obviously, would be the person that wrote it. But is it right that Jack Kirby's heirs are still fighting over Thor and Iron Man and stuff like this all these years later, that Marvel says, no, he made them for our company, they're ours? Shouldn't it be the author claims this, even if it was made for another company? Or should it be, well, the company paid you to create this, it belongs to them? Obviously, on the creative end, I think all of us are going to agree that, you know, the author should retain ownership. But in the more esoteric sense, who is the author of, say, Superman? Is it DC Comics or Siegel and Schuster, really?
I would say that the company owns the story, and they own the right to publish the story and to make money from the story. But the individual characters, if I come up with Fellatio Banana Man, and I make
that
it
for...
That
is a fantastic name right there, by the way.
Thank you.
And you have to spell Fellatio with a PH just to be funny.
Yes, because he's also a doctor. And I make it for your comic book company, Josh. You own the ability to publish all of the stories that I made of Fellatio Banana Man, but I did create the character. And you can have the next person continue the adventures, but the next person did not create the character. They're building on something that I made for you. You paid for my time creating the stories and the pages, and you can have your fabulous house full of cocaine because of this. But it wouldn't have started if I didn't have the idea. And ideas are a lot harder to pull off than people give them credit for. So I will never not say that the person who came up with the character is the originator of the idea, and they are the original author of it.
I think from a practical point of view, when you're talking about it, it's been done as a business arrangement. If you go to a company and you're commissioned to do some work for them, as in any industry, there is a certain amount of you have signed over your time for a certain amount of money, And these are the conditions. And this is where, you know, people who are in the creative business perhaps have to be a little bit more careful, because, yeah, you're going to get companies that will go, right, okay, you do this for us. And suddenly whatever your work is becomes extraordinarily lucrative. But, you know, you were doing a job just on for a week or something like that. And it does seem desperately unfair, but, I think it's a real shame when that happens.
Well, but you also got just the sleazy tactics that make this dirtier than it needs to be. Mm-hmm. To go back to DC Comics, they had a practice in the 70s, which was not since deemed illegal, where they would put the contract for the characters on the back of your check. So if you wanted to sign your paycheck, that was also you signing over the rights to the work you'd already done. So if you want to cash the check, we own everything.
Well, and
that was deemed highly illegal.
And yes. Josh and Glenn, I don't know if you know about this, but it was in place in their contracts. I don't know if it's still in place. I would not be surprised if it was, if it was, because it's the kind of thing that they would do. If you work for Disney, anything that you do, even in your off time while you work for them, if it's creative, they own it. So there are a lot of people who have a magical box in their house or their office, and it stays sealed the entire time they work for Disney. And then as soon as they leave, they open it, and there's all of this work that they've done. They don't know how it got there.
It actually happens in the tech industries and everything as well. If you're working for certain companies, if you create something during that time, even if it's your time that you're using to create that, it can be claimed by the company that you work for. That does strike me as morally bankrupt, to say the least, when that kind of stuff happens, and I wish companies would refrain from doing that kind of stuff, because I think it's bad for creativity in general. Yeah.
Josh, what do you think of ownership there?
As a creator, now I might be the exception here. I don't think I am, but I might be. That say you've got Fellatio Banana Man. You're passionate about this character. You so want to make this character, but you can't afford to do it on your own. And the only place who's interested is a place where you have to sign the rights over. I don't think I would do it. It comes down to a perfect example of being The Simpsons. Do you guys know how The Simpsons actually came about? And it falls totally into this trap here?
No, I don't.
Okay, prior to The Simpsons, Matt Groening had a comic strip called From Hell. That's the bunny with the one ear.
Life in Hell.
Life in Hell, yeah. From Hell is the fucking Edgar Allan Poe thing, sorry. Life in Hell. See, Sarah's a cartoonist, so. Life in Hell. And he was actually going into this relatively new company, you know, Fox Studios for the Fox Network, and he was going to pitch them Life in Hell. And he got cold feet while waiting in the lobby for his meeting. If I sell them this, then they own it. So he quick changed the Life in Hell characters into what became The Simpsons, all because he didn't want Fox to take his baby from him. You know, you get stories like that. You even have to go to comic books, Image Comics, which I think is the example of just how uncreative they were. All the guys who left Marvel Comics to go do Image, when they went to Image and, yes, we can create anything we want and we own it completely, every single thing they did was a clone of what they were doing at Marvel Comics.
There were so many Wolverines.
Yeah, so many Wolverines, so many everything.
Spider-Men.
It was just kind of like, what? Really? That you just changed enough to now that you own it. It seems like you didn't have much creativity to begin with. So where does it come to, like, with the Image Comics thing? That, Glenn, if you just make, or let's even turn this into a movie scenario. You make a big budget movie for a studio, original characters. This is not an adaptation. and they own it. You really want to go into a different direction that they don't want. So you just basically make carbon copies that you change a little bit and make them into a little independent film. Is that actually being creative, or is that just being derivative of yourself?
That's a good question. Yeah, it's being derivative in some respects. So you could look at it as taking back control of something you originally had, although I would question the ethics of doing it in that fashion. As much as I hate the idea of somebody else owning your ideas, and I do hate that kind of thing where you've basically signed away, you know, your creative baby. I think I can sort of understand it if a director kind or a writer or a artist goes, well, you know, I want to sort of explore this idea and go ahead a bit further. I don't know if this is kind of relevant, but Harry Bromley Davenport, who directed Extro. If you've
Which
ever
is
seen
a
Extra.
A fantastic movie with two terrible sequels.
Yes. But if you notice, the sequels were extraordinarily different to the original.
Jan Michael Vincent is in the sequel.
there's a reason why it's so absolutely different. He told me he basically, when he did the original, the only thing he walked away from that film with at the end of it, other than a paycheck, was the rights to the name. So when he kind of like moved on in his career a little bit, he kind of looked at it, well, I've got the rights to the word Extro, to the title Extro for a film, so I can't make it a sequel. I can't do a remake, so I'll just make another film and name it Extro. So that's why they're so violently different. You know, they are incredibly different films.
And the third film wasn't even made as an Extro film. That was just a film called Watch the Skies that they bought and said, hey, we have the rights to Extro. Now it's Extro 3.
Yes.
Josh, Glenn, have you been paying attention to video games? Because Konami has been fucking up so much. I don't know if you know about this little game that was kickstarted called Mighty Number 9. It was made by the guy who created Mega Man. But when he left Konami, they threw a bitch fit. They have not put out anything, any new Mega Man games since then. They keep on announcing and canceling them. So he put together this thing that isn't 95% Mega Man, they just changed his name. And it got fully funded. It's out. People are loving it. Same thing with guys who used to work on Banjo-Kazooie. They got, I think that they asked for like 14,000 British pounds. And they are, I don't know what they are in pounds, but it's over $2 million that they, and they're still getting money.
Unless the exchange rate's more fucked than I realize, that's a lot more.
It's 1.6 $1.6 to the pound.
Yeah, they've almost hit all of their stretch goals, and their last stretch goal is to have the thing fully orchestrated.
Well, I know that Toe Jam and Earl, they're making a third, technically was a third, but nobody cares to call it that. They're, you know, to making a new Toe Jam and Earl game, even though they technically don't have the rights to it.
Oh, but did you hear about the latest thing that Konami did? Is after Kojima left, we don't know why he left, but there was a little teaser game called PT, which was supposed to lead into the next Silent Hill game.
Yeah, and now they've had a complete data purge of anything Kojima touched.
Yeah, it's not just that. It was up on the PlayStation site. You could download it, but without telling anyone this, they took all of the code off of the PlayStation site. So unless you had it downloaded into your system, there is no way for you to legally ever get that. And it was a free game.
Well, before we finish off tonight, that kind of a dick move, let's go to Watchmen and DC Comics. Now, DC Comics, when they made Watchmen, this was not part of the DC universe, so that's why you didn't have Superman and whatnot. A little bit of history here. Charlton was of another comic company who had went out of business shortly before Watchmen was made. Watchmen was originally supposed to be the Charlton characters, which would be Blue Beetle and the Shield and stuff like that. Well, DC had acquired those, and that's what Alan Moore was hired to write. That's what the Watchmen was supposed to be, essentially an alternate universe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they got cold feet saying, we actually want to use the Charlton characters in the regular DC universe, so change your characters. So he did. Now, these are completely original characters. They're derivative, but they're original characters that Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons have created. Now, yes. The deal that DC made with Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons was, we have the right to publish Watchmen. And once we stop printing the books or the trades, after 1 year, the rights revert back to you. Alan Moore said that's a very fair deal. And I agree. That's a very fair deal. Problem is, even when no one cared in the 90s about Watchmen, DC would put out one token printing of the trade paperback every year just to stop the rights from reverting back to Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. Even though they didn't care and these things didn't sell for shit. It was specifically, we have to print this so the rights don't go back to them.
Oh,
that
God.
Is supreme dick move-ish.
It's not like I haven't almost heard this story before, but that's right up there with making a Fantastic Four movie that you never planned to put out.
Corman. but I mean, Glenn, I know you not being the comic book guy. Does that surprise you with the whole Watchmen situation that they – and Alan Moore said he entered into this and he thinks the editor he entered into it with had good faith that, you know, a year later these characters would return to him. And then someone in corporate said, we're not giving up a fucking cash cow. Just do a token printing. Boom. Characters are ours again for another year.
Doesn't surprise me in the slightest. I think if you go into a deal these days with any big corporation and you expect good faith, then you're being incredibly naive. And that's not to say that I'm certainly not pouring any scorn on those guys because of that. Because, you know, regular guys, you tend to trust people. But the big businesses will always try to protect their interests, regardless of what the morality is, and that is certainly pretty damned low kind of behavior. And, you know, the more people that know it, hopefully the less people will kind of fall into those kind of traps. However, corporations are, you know, notoriously devious. They will just find new and more interesting and exciting ways to screw us, basically.
Yeah, but some people are all too – Henry Rollins has this great quote. If he's talking to independent bands, if you're not willing to sell yourself out, there are all these people with their hands extended willing to sell you out for you. And then I think that is too much of the prevailing attitude. For instance, I personally know a couple of comic writers who are like, I hate DC Comics and Warner Brothers and they're scum. And, you know, they try to take my creation, but I really want to write or draw Batman. So they'll go and do it because they really want to write and draw Batman. That's kind of selling yourself out despite not wanting to sell yourself out, isn't it?
Well, we all have ambitions and we want to move on in the world, don't we? So that's kind of one of the prices of doing it, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I would probably work for Disney if I would be able to make a hard R Punisher movie set in 1982, yeah. Set against 42nd yeah. Street. I'd say, you know what? I will fucking take it up the ass for Disney every night. I can learn to walk with this.
Well, Josh, it is one of those things. It's like the Matt Groening story that you told, that they're not seeing it as I'm doing this and I'm completely selling this out, because I'm not saying all of them do, but some of them might have a property, a story that they want to tell, and they're keeping that separated. You know, this is the whoring out that I'm doing on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, I'm feeding my kids. And the money might come from the whoring out and feeding the kids. Those might be connected, but they can separate those two.
You hope they can. You know what I can't separate, though? is Glenn Criddle from his work.
Oh.
Where can people see that?
Yeah, you can.
That
find
was meant
me
as a compliment. You kind of took it out as seemed like a little. Oh, that was a shot. Oh.
No, it's fine. Yeah, where can you find me? You can find me on YouTube as LampyMan101, and you can find me on Geek Juice Media.
And where can we find Sarah Hanley's stuff? And yes, I know we've been talking about the 1201 Beyond redesign forever, but it really is coming. We're trying to hit it for June, so it'll be relatively soon.
Okay, but if we hit June, I don't want to hear anything from her lawyers, okay? Not this time.
But yeah, people can find you at 1201. What do you do there, besides this, obviously?
Besides this, I have funny little pictures that are drawn in a very scandalous manner, because I'm just that kind of a gal.
I don't know if that's overselling or underselling. And you can find me at 1201beyond.com. You can contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. If you want to help donate or anything, you can use that same email address to help PayPal, help keep the lights on. Or you guys go to adamandeve.com and use the promo code STATIC. You know, that helps out too. Or, you know, and remember, Drive Through RPG, L. Seeger's role-playing game materials. So I want to say, I think people should not sell out themselves, but at the same time, I think the author is the author and not the director. You know, if you do work for a company, your boss is not the author of that work. You are.
And I'll make another video next week as well. Me, Ian Rotten, you know, the Ian Rotten Man, me, I love me.
Get lost. Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.